Hey there, conductors. If you've ever felt that you're not quite sure what to do next when you're studying a score, maybe you don't even know where to start with a difficult piece, maybe you study one piece too much and then you realize at the first rehearsal that you don't know another one well enough, or maybe you're a new conductor and you don't know what score study is, I'm excited to share that I'm finally publishing and sharing my score study checklist. I've been refining this for 12 years now, and I'm so excited to share it. It is going to walk you through my structure, my process to make sure that I learn every score that I need to learn well enough and so that nothing falls through the cracks. So it covers everything that you need to know. There's a link in the show notes. Go ahead and click it, sign up, and you'll get that score study checklist sent right to your email. You'll also get access to an 8-minute video of me explaining what each section is and how I use it to organize all the music that I need to learn. It's only 8 minutes, so it's not going to take you a whole hour to learn how to study better, how to put up a process for your score study, and how to make sure that nothing is falling through the cracks. So again, click the link in the show notes, and I hope to see you soon. Now, please enjoy this episode of Podium Time. Welcome to Podium Time, the podcast for conductors and students.
At a young level, as soon as a conductor can get out of their own head and stop thinking about themselves, that's when, you know, music happens. It's a step that everyone goes through. And I think part of that is relaxing and not being so serious about yourself. I mean, be serious about the music, because it's only about the music. It's never about you. It's never about the conductor. You serve at any level, but you're serving. You serve someone. You're not being served. And that's any level, you know, college, amateur, professional.
David, welcome to Podium Time. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeremy. It's great to be here.
Awesome.
Our lockdown venues.
I like to lock myself in the closet. When people are home, it keeps the apartment quiet.
Exactly. I understand. As I mentioned earlier, I live pretty much facing Broadway in Manhattan. So there may be a siren.
Gotcha.
I'll try and do something about that.
We're close enough to the highway that I've got that big like brick wall, but far enough that I can't actually hear it from here.
So that's
we're
good.
A couple buildings down. Yeah, it's a pretty.
Yeah, I don't
nice
think we can put that in on the Upper West Side.
Awesome. Speaking of Upper West Side, you are music director of the New York Repertory Orchestra and founder, right?
Yes. Yeah. I started the orchestra in the 90s, in the mid-90s, as a reading orchestra because I had participated in a conducting workshop at Columbia University. I forget who was the host of it, but they used the orchestra at Columbia. And it wasn't a great experience in many ways. It was very interesting. But I thought, well, you know, I could take that money and I could call up all my friends because I'm an oboist originally. So, and I, you know, was doing a lot of freelance playing here in New York, and all my friends that I played with knew I was interested in conducting. And I rented a space in one of the high schools, and we started as a reading orchestra. So a couple of times a month we'd get together and read through stuff that I thought they would be interested in playing, that they didn't always get a chance to play. It wasn't so much that I wanted to conduct music that I wanted to conduct. Mm. It didn't matter to me. And actually that's sort of how I feel in general. But I figured the draw to get people to come in for nothing and read through stuff would be to do stuff that they, you know, hadn't had a chance to do. So after a few years of that, I realized that wind players like me love to sight read anything, you know,
really
into we're wind players like to sight read generally. String players hate it because, you know, string players are in wind players are soloists essentially, no matter what, you know, second oboe, first flute, you're a soloist on that part. And string players are in the group and they like to have their bowings and they like to have all that stuff ahead of time. And we were definitely not doing anything ahead of time.
I
would get the music and hand it out there, and we would read through stuff.
Gotcha.
So we did a couple of concerts now and then, like once a year we would do one at a friendly church. And then I realized that the string players and other players too had commitments in other orchestras that they were playing in, and they prioritized those because they had performances. Yeah. So it was more difficult to get people to come in every 2 weeks. And, you know, we always had a different number of players coming in. And, anyway, we started as a reading orchestra, as I say, and then in 2000 we started giving concerts to keep people playing with us.
Yeah.
So they could prioritize their schedules, aiming at a concert. You know, there was if you had a concert as the end goal, people are more likely to stick around. So that was in February of 2000, and since then, as I said, we were there in that church by Lincoln Center, right behind Juilliard, for 10 years. And the audience got too big. I'm happy to say the orchestra got bigger, and we moved to a church in Midtown, just off Times Square, a huge space, Church of St. Mary the Virgin. And we've been there for 10 years. So that's been the story of the orchestra, and it's grown. You know, it's a big group, and it's a fantastic group. Many of the players are professional.
But
everyone is a volunteer. You know, we have great soloists. We have folks from the principal chairs of the Met and the Philharmonic, and singers from the Met. And you know, it's a wonderful group. I love them. I love the players. They're wonderful. They really are. I don't mean to sound like I'm pandering to them, but it's a really nice bunch. Very talented and hardworking. They're committed, and there's a real sense of family, as I've learned.
Yeah.
The pandemic, just emailing the group and one-on-one conversations with everyone, how they miss it, and you know what a part of their life it's been, especially now that it's not happening.
Well, and I love that you've been able to build it into that. You know, you said at the beginning it was tough to get people to commit, to be really into it, and now it's like it's even surviving going dark and, you know, not being able to perform together.
Right. Yeah. In the beginning, when I put it together as a reading orchestra, we would meet every 2 weeks, and I would spend almost two entire weeks on the phone. trying to round up people, and they were all friends and they're all happy to play if they could, but I never knew from week to week who was coming.
Yeah.
And it became much easier when we started to plan concerts, because then there was a level of commitment that was that they were able to have, and that really helped.
What were the first couple concerts like? Were they like big rep or?
Yeah, the first concert was, I remember it very well. The first concert was Verdi's La Forza Overture, the Prelude and Liebestod from Tristan.
Wow.
And the Prokofiev Fifth Symphony.
That's a meaty program.
Looking back, my feeling was that this is how we start as we mean to go on. You know.
Yes.
It was sort of the mission of the group is that we would do this. We would do big pieces. We would do a meaty repertoire, and then as we grew, as we went on, I grew up in New York, and I've played in I've done a lot of freelance playing, and in college I played in every volunteer community orchestra, and I know them all well, and I've either conducted them or played in them. And the issues that I had with them were that the music repertoire choices were really, you know, very mainstream.
Yeah.
And that's fine. And I wanted sort of our group to be different, and since then, I would say that the repertoire that we do is different than any other similar organization.
How so?
I think I mentioned to you, well, in the 20 years that we've been playing, we've never repeated anything.
Like not even.
We repeated
like a Beethoven symphony.
We repeated one concerto.
Wow.
So we've transversed, the Beethoven symphonies, but and Brahms and Schumann, etc. But that's not our core. Our core music is really what I think is the meat of the repertoire, of the orchestral repertoire, which is the 20th century. I mean, absolutely Beethoven, Mozart, Schumann, Brahms, Wagner is wonderful. But the 20th century orchestral repertoire is brilliant, colorful, and exciting in many ways, and also new to a lot of players. So by doing that, we give the players an opportunity to do stuff that they haven't done before. And so, for example, a lot of the music that we've done is Sibelius. I mean, and all the symphonies. We've done all the Sibelius symphonies except for the last one, which we were going to do this year.
Seven is great.
Right.
I
Well,
love
that's the one we're waiting to do.
it.
All the Nielsen symphonies except the last one, we're trying to do a series of the Martinu symphonies. And we've done a bunch of the Martinu concerti. A lot of American music, David Diamond, Walter Piston, William Schumann, Barber. Those mid-century pieces that are not done so much anymore. In addition to commissioning, and that stuff interests me a lot because it doesn't get done. And in fact, a lot of the repertoire that's done, the standard repertoire, even orchestras that want to do standard repertoire, they don't have to do the same three pieces. So, an orchestra that's done Dvorak, the last three Dvorak symphonies, 7, 8, and 9, they could do six.
Six is
That's
awesome.
less done. Six is great.
Love
And in many
six.
ways, the journey that an audience takes is the same in those pieces. They're great pieces. They're wonderful. The music is terrific, and obviously they're different in the ways that each one is different. But the journey is this wonderful musical journey that takes you from the beginning to the end in an arc. And six is as valid as 7, 8, and 9. And I don't know why people only do, well, even seven is rare, but 8 and 9.
Yeah, six and seven I only learned about last year,
Right.
and I like six and seven way more than eight and nine now.
I think seven, I mean, I like eight. I like eight a lot. I've done it a bunch of times. But I think seven is so Czech.
Yeah, and it
I
like
think,
blew me out. I was like, how have I not heard
right.
this
I mean, I
incredible
think
music before?
eight is very much Dvorak trying to be Brahms.
Isn't
It's
six also
much,
though?
six has its, has a furiant movement, the minuet, not minuet, the scherzo, that die, 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 dum. It has that going on. And it's a little more, Bohemian hills and rustic thing. But eight, I think, is very formal. I mean, it's gorgeous. It's gorgeous. I mean, I'm not saying it's not, but I think more, seven is very personal. Nine, of course, is perfect in every way, which is why it's such a warhorse. It's effortless. It's effortlessly amazing. But there are these other pieces. The same thing with Sibelius. People do two and maybe five. But six is amazing. Four is unbelievable. And three, I mean, they're all fantastic in different ways. I often feel that the Sibelius symphonies, all seven of them, are one piece. It's a progression from one, which is this enormous thing. And they all taper down, they get more and more essential, more and more spare, more and more refined, until you have that last movement, that one movement of the Seventh Symphony, basically, which is, I mean, it's 20 minutes long, and it's as big a statement as the second or the first. And the same thing is true with Shostakovich and Prokofiev. You know, Prokofiev, people do one. Everyone knows one. And people know five. I think that's on, but we in the last couple of years we've done six and seven. And they're unbelievable. Unbelievable. And I think that's a missed opportunity for many organizations who are looking to do different music and they don't want to alienate their audiences. So they say, well, we'll do Sibelius 2 again. But you know, you could do, you know, an audience that doesn't know it doesn't, they know it's Sibelius. And I think orchestras administrators are afraid unnecessarily of doing something a little different without being they're not adventurous. The same is true in with Shostakovich. I know that the forces for Shostakovich orchestras are large, but there are several that are, if you're going to do five, you can do 10 probably, or one.
I love that. I love
I think it's a question of looking around and seeing what's it right around you.
that.
It's not even far to look. And it frustrates me when I see orchestras not looking around like that for the, you know, that's the easy stuff. That's the stuff that's right around you. And then you can save your energies for looking, you know, for new commissioning and new works, new composers, and really offbeat stuff. So yeah, that's in relation to Nairo. That's kind of what we've done. We've sort of forged a path where we're doing that kind of thing, looking at composers we all know, but the music that we don't know of them because it's never done. You know, I would say that if an orchestra is going to do the Franck D minor, well, the Chausson symphony and B flat symphony is not superior. I like both of them very much, but I'm a huge Chausson fan. He's very neglected, I think, unnecessarily. You know, people know the violin piece, I forget what it is, the romance or the whatever, it's that solo, famous solo violin piece. But there's the symphony, which is amazing, and there's a piece for singer, the Song of Love in the Sea, poem of love. Oh, the violin piece is the poem, and this is also the poem of love in the sea, and it's this big three movement work for basically a Wagnerian soprano or tenor, either can sing it, and it's stunning, and it's very rarely done. And you know, even in someone like Beethoven, those works are not equally spread out. You know, everyone does. You know, you hear five all the time, you hear seven all the time, you hear nine all the time, but you don't hear eight that much. You don't hear four, and those are just amazing pieces. So I think, you know, in terms of repertoire, you can look around. And then for the repertoire that we do that no one has heard of, you know, I keep lists, and I, you know, when I hear something on a radio, I make notes, and I talk to people, and my orchestra players know that they can always suggest new pieces to me, as long as it's not something that they know I know. Like, you don't have to recommend the Schumann Second Symphony. I know about it. And, you know, if we program it, we'll program it. But I want to know about things I don't know. And someone, one of our horn players, who always has great suggestions, we've done two pieces that he suggested. One was the interludes from the Palestrina opera by, what's his name? Fitzner.
I don't know
Exactly.
it.
There's an opera called Palestrina. The Met did it, like, I don't know, 10 years ago. They premiered it after, you know, years and years. It never been done, and it's really stunning. You know, Fitzner, his music is good. This is very good.
Yeah.
Right. So, and then he also suggested a symphony by an English composer named Moeran, Moeran. And I heard, the first 10 measures, and I thought, oh, we have to do this piece. This is fantastic. And I'd never heard of him. I'd never heard of him. And that's why on the Naira website, I have a list of all the repertoire that we've done of a page. So I can refer to it because I don't offhand, it's very hard for me to remember. And in fact, I'm sort of looking at it now. All the things that we've done, lots of Britten, which is great, Chausson and Delajoio, I like very much, American composer. That stuff is out there. And then that's in addition to the commissions. We've gotten through all the Beethoven symphonies over the years and standard rep also. And that's not our main thing, though, And I think what that does, there are two things that that does, at least two that I can think of. One is it makes us unique. So that's good for grant writing and things like that. We can point to that. Actually, it's three things. It also gives the orchestra the opportunity to play stuff that they've never played. And that's why I think people like playing with us. I would say 90% of the music we play in a season, most of the
Totally,
orchestra has
totally
never played
know.
before. And the other thing is the audience has built up trust in us so that they're not making the decision to come to us or not because they know the piece or not, which I know
Yeah,
is
they're
something
going for the
that
orchestra.
right. And I know that's a question that orchestra managements ponder and worry about. Well, if we don't do Beethoven 5, the audience isn't going to come. And I think that's a question of building up trust in the audience that over time they'll realize if you give them a really great performance, you do as great a performance as you can, that they'll trust you, that they know that they're not going to know everything, but they're going to trust that what they hear, at least one or two of the three pieces or four pieces, that they'll like. They may not like everything, but they're there. And I think that really breeds a nice feeling from the audience, and the expectation is more positive than negative. They come with a positive expectation, not, oh, I don't know this piece. Why, why should I be here? But oh, I don't know this piece. We've had good experience with the stuff they picked before. Let's, do it. And I think that's happened. Our audience is, from what we know, loyal and has been as keeps coming. So, really, really happy about that. The other thing I think that brings in an audience is, I think this is true. I'm not sure. I'm still sort of debating whether a soloist is needed or not. Because we've had our first several years of concerts, maybe the first 2 years, we never had soloists. For some reason, I don't know why. Right in front of me, I didn't see it, but I think I thought about it, and then we started to do it. And I don't know that I noticed an uptick, but when we do have soloists now, they play with us, I think, because most of our soloists have been back with us many times, and they play for us. They want to play with us because I basically say, "We'll play whatever you want to play."
And the soloist likes that.
Right, which means that we've had a chance to do really interesting stuff like the Martinu Violin Concerto and the Nielsen Violin Concerto and the Nielsen Flute Concerto, the principal flute at the Met, Stefan Huskilson, who's now principal flute at Chicago Symphony. I met through a friend, and I was really interested in having him come and play the Nielsen Concerto with us. And I knew from my friend that he was very interested in playing the Bach B minor suite. So I met him for lunch, and we had a very nice chat. We hit it off. He said, "Oh, I'm very interested in doing the Bach." I said, "Oh, that's a great piece. You know what's also a great piece? The Nielsen. Isn't the Nielsen a great piece?" And he said, "Yeah, the Nielsen's a great piece." So I said, "Well, let's do both."
Yeah.
I said, "It's not any more than playing Goethe Dammerung."
Yeah.
And so he did. So he did. And we did the Bach and the Nielsen. And then he came back and we did Lowell Lieberman's Flute Concerto.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was a way, you know, it's not like we have huge fees to give soloists. So it has to be something worth it. So, you know, for that reason, we've done not just the Shostakovich Cello Concerto that everyone does, the first one, but we've also done the second one because that's what a soloist was interested in doing, yeah, or was going to do with another, you know,
yeah,
a
yeah,
big group.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and things like the Elgar Violin Concerto that one of our soloists, someone I've been playing with since she was 14 and now she's a mother with her second child on the way. You know, I think I've played with her every standard concerto,
yeah,
here and with other groups too. And mm-hmm, so we love coming up with all these holes. We love coming up with stuff that they haven't done before. One of the interesting things was one of our soloists who's the concertmaster of Minnesota Orchestra. This was before she got that job. So she was in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Well, what do you want to do?" And she said, "You know, I've never played with an orchestra, the Bruch Scottish Fantasy."
Yeah.
I said, "Well, we've never done it.
Yeah.
You should do it. Let's do it." So, you know, there was real motivation there. Mm-hmm. You know, that really helps. And these are great soloists, so that helps also our audience sees that, and they also bring in, you know, they're New York based mostly. So there's a you know, when the principal violist from the Philharmonic comes to play with us, we have every violist in the city in the crowd. And we had one of the bass players from Lincoln Center Chamber Music Society, who's very well known. We had bass players coming just out of the woodwork. We had to set up a special room to store everyone's bass because they were all coming from gigs or on their way to gigs.
Yeah.
So they had to hear him play. So, yeah, and then this past year we did the finale from Siegfried.
Mm,
so okay. We had the soprano just sang at the Met. She was in Pique Dame, and the tenor sings at San Francisco Opera all the time. And they're a couple, by the way. Now they're engaged. No credit to us though. You know, I knew him and he knew her, and let's do this thing. This was just like,
yeah,
great for the orchestra, because we had never, you know, no one gets to play Wagner operas, and this is the full orchestration,
yeah,
not a reduction.
Good.
So, you know, that was a lot of fun. And good for the orchestra, good for the audience. So,
mm-hmm,
you know, that's kind of our thing, is carves out a territory, a niche, yeah, for us people.
Mm-hmm. So when the orchestra not repeating pieces, is that something that happened on accident, or was that a conscious choice at some point?
I think it happened accidentally on purpose, in that,
mm-hmm,
the first several years it happened because I just wanted to do different things. And then after a while, I realized that we had done that and there was no going back.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's our 20th year this year of doing concerts. And I feel like, well, now we could just go back and do all those programs.
20
again.
Years of the program.
Just do the same programs. Because the programs are really good. I really agonize about making sure that the programs are really balanced so that,
yeah,
they stand up as a unit, not just a group of pieces,
yeah,
thrown together for whatever reason. So
what does balanced mean for you in there? Can you talk about that a bit?
Oh, sure. I like a certain type of variety,
okay,
with an underlying logic. So to me, I'm in an enviable position in that my programs are what I determine them to be. There's no second guessing from a board.
Yeah.
From the board, I'm allowed to do that, which is I'm very lucky. I'm
or
very
like
lucky.
A marketing director.
Right. So yeah. I'm very lucky in that respect. But I like there to be some sort of logic in the way the pieces are together. And it doesn't necessarily have to be evident to the audience.
Okay.
It's evident to me.
Yeah.
And if I feel they go together, that's enough. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy to explain it to anyone.
Yeah.
If they want to know. But I'm very much not in favor of overt thematic programming, because how many times can you see Fire and Ice Day and Night? My favorite was one that a friend of mine played with the Queen's Orchestra years ago. He said, guess what the theme is? A tour of Europe. Well,
yeah,
that just sounds like every concert I've ever been to. But
every
you know,
concert's a tour of Europe anyway.
Concert's a tour of Europe. But imposing a theme that's not musically that's not musically generated, I don't like. I mean, it can work. I'm not against it. For me, it doesn't work. You know, trying to come up with, you know, if marketing says, oh, let's do, you know, for example, Fire and Ice. Okay, so, all right. But what does that have to do with the way the music comes together? There's the Firebird, and there's, you know, some Tchaikovsky, like Winter Dreams or something. But I don't know what the relationship they have among each other is. Often I find, and I find this accidentally, that when pieces come together, that they'll have similar rhythmic components.
Oh, okay.
That, you know, I could consciously that might happen, but often I look back and think, oh, you know, there is a logic, another logic in these pieces. You know, they'll deal with the same same meters in different ways. Like, I can't think of a good example, but for example, the Rachmaninoff Isle of the Dead, which is in 5/8, and then something else which uses 5/8, like something by Turina, not the Procession del Rocío, Danzas Fantásticas have a movement that's also in 5, and the treatment of the 5 is very different. Like one sounds like very Spanish folk, and the Rachmaninoff, that's not the Rachmaninoff. The Turina has this very Spanish, obviously, feeling. He's painting a picture of Spain, and festivals in Spain, and then the Rachmaninoff, the 5/8, he uses it to paint the waves, the undulation of the waves.
Mm-hmm.
And the brilliant way that he creates a retard or an accelerando just by flipping 2 against 3, three against 2. So, da di di da dum di da di da dum da da dum di dum. So it rushes, you know, it pulls back and it moves forward. It's brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, that might be something that is put together in a program. You know, I'm not going to call it, here's our 5/8 program, but it, you know, there's an internal logic, and it's not necessarily, it doesn't necessarily need to be obvious to the audience. If I feel that the pieces go together, then they do. There's a logic to it that I understand. And as I say, I can explain it if needed, but I don't think it's necessary.
Yeah. Do you usually start with one large piece and then fit in around it, or start with the soloist, or, you know, what's the very beginning of each program?
It's really the soloists.
Okay.
So I have enormous lists. I have an enormous list every year that gets longer and shorter as I go through stuff and plan stuff. And I know, so every year I'll have an idea of the main pieces that I want us to do and the soloists that we'll have, and it really has to start with what the soloists are doing. So I'm happy to change my ideas of what the big pieces need to be. I mean, I have an idea of what type they, what, you know, what genre or what, you know, period or that type of thing, how they contrast. But that can change.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously the soloists, because they have to come in, you know, they can only come in on a certain date. They pick their date.
Yeah.
We just determine what they're going to do. And then I try and find stuff that's going to complement that as much as possible without being too similar. I did a program years ago with another orchestra that was Tannhäuser Overture, Mozart Oboe Concerto, Schubert Ninth Symphony. And those are great pieces on their own.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I felt at the end of the program, so I felt it was so oppressively heavy. And I generally try and make concerts not all one nationality or one mm-hmm. style. So yeah. I would never program something like that again, unless there was an extremely good reason for it. Mm-hmm. I just think it's dull. It's dull programming, you know, in a way that it just, okay, here's the Wagner. Mozart is slightly different. And here's Schubert. And yeah, they're different, but there is a certain heaviness, a certain seriousness
yeah.
that a little of goes a long way. And I very much like mixing national styles, compositional styles, eras, you know, time periods with programs. So I would never do something like that. I very much mm-hmm. like to find, I also very much like to find the non-German music. So, you know, looking for a lot of Italian music over the years, Pizzetti, you know, never heard of Pizzetti. I mean, some Respighi, you know, Verdi stuff that's never done, some of the overtures from earlier operas, things like that. Looking at Spain, looking at Latin America. You know, Mexico and down through South America. Spain, also Scandinavia. I mean, I do a lot of Scandinavian music. One of the composers that I like very much and have done a lot of music of is Eduard Tubin, who's Estonian, he died in 85. And again, it was someone recommended that to me. They saw our program and said, you would like music of Tubin. And I do.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a great thing to find. The only people who perform his music are me and the entire Järvi family. Because they're Estonian and they've done, so we've done, I'm happy to say, we've done New York premieres of most of the symphonies
yeah.
that we've done because Nemi Järvi, wonderful, Nemi Järvi, did them in New Jersey when he was with he conducted the New Jersey Symphony Orchestra. So they weren't in New York. So yeah. I can say New York premiere. So, you know,
mm-hmm.
That's kind of our thing.
Awesome. And so I'm wondering whether we should bring up, we wanted to talk about opera, and then we also wanted to talk about languages a little bit. And we were kind of teetering on the edge of both of those
sure.
topics. What do you?
Well, they
what do you
go think? Together, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Duh, I didn't think about that, but yeah, of course.
No, it just occurred to me.
Know.
It just occurred to me as we were talking about it. Yes, there's language in opera.
Yeah.
The you know, as far as we were talking about this for conductor training,
mm-hmm.
things like that, and I mentioned that you know, my orchestra started because of a not great workshop experience I had. I thought I could take my money and use it to better effect, but I've certainly been in wonderful workshops, and I've taught many workshops, so I'm not against them per se. But this was just one instance many years ago that sort of sent me in this direction, and you know, the thing that for young conductors who are looking to conduct, I think it's very rare that that you're going to go to a workshop and the teacher there is going to point to you and say, you're exactly what we're looking for in the musical world. Come with me. I'm going to show you how to become, I'm going to take you through the door to the path that takes you to the top of the profession. That very rarely happens. So, everyone is looking for opportunity. And in my case, I created my own opportunity with the Reading Orchestra. And then when we shifted to a concertizing group, one of the things about the Reading Orchestra I just wanted to mention is that after a while, for a conductor, it's sort of a trick to bring an orchestra through a piece reading first time. You're not really rehearsing the piece, you're not really getting into the music. And after a while, that becomes okay. It's less of a challenge because the technique you have is there, and you can do it, and you can get people through it, and who are just sight reading. Workshops are important. I think there's nothing more valuable for young conducting students than to go make their own opportunities, and also to become as familiar with opera as possible, opera conducting. Because I know Kleiber said that opera conducting is technique, and symphonic conducting is emotion, but opera is technique. And you, if you don't have a good technique for opera, you're dead because there's so much going on. You really need to be able to, and you need the music too, but you really need to be able to show exactly what's going on. You need the ability, for example, in Mozart, accompanied recitatives, to be able to be perfectly still, waiting for, if you're waiting for the singer to get to the beat that you're going to cue the orchestra on, to come in with the ta-tum, or da-dum da-dum. And if you're sort of moving around with your stick, if you're I sort of call it thinking with your hands. The orchestra can see your hand moving because you're thinking, and your hands are moving while you're thinking. And the ability not to do that is very important. You need to be still, think in your own head. And you see that in young conductors when they start a piece. I see this many, many times. They'll give like nine preparations to the beat because they're thinking the tempo, and they don't realize that their hand is moving also, and there's like up, down, up, and the orchestra doesn't know where you are. So I think opera really teaches you that, and workshops, I certainly try and teach that. It's a way of, you have to, opera makes you look at yourself from outside in a way that getting up in front of an orchestra and doing a Beethoven symphony doesn't necessarily, because orchestras are going to play a Beethoven symphony, but an orchestra is not necessarily going to come in with the recitative, the little punctuation of a recitative, unless you really show them where it is. You'll have half the orchestra doing one thing and half the other, and that's not a good thing. So, and working in opera, and also something I remember hearing when I was in school, I went to Brooklyn College, the Conservatory of Music at Brooklyn College, and the orchestra director there, it was very interesting. She was my first conducting teacher in many ways. And she always used to say that American musicians generally had a harder time playing in 3/8 or 6/8 for some reason. There's just something about the language that makes it more difficult than, say, French musicians to play in 6/8. I don't know why that is, but I certainly noticed that it was true. I became very aware of that. And I think that has to do with rhythm of language. I mean, you can certainly learn to do it correctly, but I think, with students coming in off the out of high school or something, it is a little difficult to feel that because you don't. I don't know, that we're not a language that does, what is it, dactyls? No. whatever that metrical foot is, they don't do yat-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-team, yat-ta-ta-ta-tam, or that the long short of a triplet, you know, that dum-ta-ti-ta-ti-ta-ti. And I noticed that also in, she was very attuned to this, and I definitely paid attention because she could be terrifying. She didn't. But, you know, she definitely made a connection between language and, you know, how the German language shapes German music, German composers in a way that French shapes French music, the way phrases are built, the way accents are used, whether they're used in a, you know, an upbeat or a downbeat or sort of a neutrally accented thing. And this is very much the idea of agogic accents, not accents. And I try and bring this out with ensembles I work with all the time, that there's more than one way to accent than by playing loud and soft.
Yeah.
And in fact, that's a very unsophisticated way. There are accents of length that are very, that can be very effective. Accents of articulation, accents of, you know, all these different ways to articulate, all these different ways to show emphasis that are more than just a loud, you know, we're used to in Beethoven playing loud accents, which are great, but there are many other styles. And, you know, something that I work with opera singers on is there are many ways to be expressive other than making a retard at the end of a phrase. You know, that's it's a very unsophisticated way of doing it. And there are many other ways to do it. You can do it with color. You can do it with volume. You can do it with any number of things. So language really, you know, looking at language sort of made that more evident to me. I could see it more, you know, as I studied French and German and Italian. Because it's, you know, obviously the languages are very, well, they're different languages.
Yeah.
But the way that they are constructed rhythmically and metrically influences the music that's written by composers from those, that, you know, whose languages are those. Mm-hmm. So I that's something that I'm very interested in ensembles. And again, it's not something that I need, that if I know it and I can explain it in a way to an orchestra without, I mean, nothing's more boring than a conductor going on and on about, well, the circumflex in French means that, you know, this vowel is extended. No. I mean, a clear example and why mm-hmm. is good. And, you know, you're certainly welcome to talk to everyone after at the bar. But and the other thing, I mean, that follows in that is something that I've always been very not strict about, but something very interested in, very trying to be as precise and about as possible, is rhythm.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, that comes from one of my shortcomings as a incoming freshman, is that I had terrible rhythm. I didn't know, you know, playing offbeats and marches was difficult for me. And then I worked with one of the teachers at school privately, and he taught me rhythm, so that now it's one of my, I would say it's my strongest, it's one of my really strong suits, that I can hear rhythm and understand, you know, I have an understanding for it. And rhythm precision, the beauty of rhythmic precision, which goes in with language and how phrasing is done, is so important. And so many times I hear it neglected, you know, like not hearing that dotted eighth sixteenth have a 3-to-1 relationship. You know, it's somewhere between a triplet and a, you know, it's short and long. I remember my wife is a violist. She's an amateur violist, very good. And I conducted an orchestra that she played in, and we were taking the train home, and I said, so when you see a dotted rhythm, do you count, or do you just play a long note and a short note? And she said, "Well, you know, I we just here. It was, I think it was a Brahms symphony." And she said, "I, you know, we just, I think we just, because they don't, amateur training does not delve into that precise expression of rhythm that professionals have. Even some professionals don't, but you know, at least I know that they've learned it. And to me, that's so important. And I know I've said, I know people have heard me say that if I had a choice between two players and one played perfectly in tune, but not rhythmically, and someone played perfectly rhythmically and not in tune, I would take the rhythmic player because they probably do play in tune. But even if they don't, they hear better. They're listening in a different way, and they can probably learn to play in tune, but it's much more difficult to teach someone to play rhythmically after a certain period, you know, of their life, after a certain age, you know. So those are things that are really important to me. And you know, in conducting workshops and working with ensembles in at the college level, also, and every level, making things just, there's something really beautiful about working on something so that it's just shining and it's polished and shining, and it sets a tone for what comes after. I'm one of those people who fight against the inclination to work on a measure for an hour. I could, but I don't, because I know there'll be no one in the orchestra at the next rehearsal, or after the break. But you know, I think as a conductor, you have to go after that. You have to go after that, and orchestras need to see that you're serious about it, and then they're serious, and you don't, you know, you don't have to do it as much as time goes on, because they know that it's expected, and also makes such a difference to them. You know, you work on something, you play something for the first time, and then you work on it, and then it sounds better, and they can hear that. And then, you know, I'm not going to go so far as to say their eyes light up, but you know, something
But
lights up.
they know.
They know, they know. And then I certainly will say, "Do you hear that? That's, I mean, doesn't that sound better than it did?" And I was like, "Yes, it does." So, you know, getting them to hear these things. But you know, and it's everything. It's intonation, yes, but I think rhythmic precision, clear dynamics, and articulation. Without that, you know, the best intonation in the world is not going to mean anything. It's going to sound like mud. And if you do all that, though, the intonation gets better.
It does, So, what are some of the things that you and your teacher did to improve that shortcoming of rhythm for you?
This was a teacher who became a friend of mine. He was a grad student at Brooklyn College at the time, and he took me on. We did tutoring, and he did very simple things. He would put on the metronome, and we would clap to it. We would swing our arms, like you'd swing your arm in a big circle. You'd make a big circle. So, how can I describe it? You clap in the middle, and you swing your arms out in a big arc, and then you come back into the middle, and you know, it's like you're doing a round of applause. You're doing a round clap, and you do that. You know, you stand up and you do that with a metronome, and when you do that, you divide it. You go, you know, you go into two, clap, da, clap, and then you do triplets, but it's tied to your physicality. You know, you go ta 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 ti ta ta. Ta 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 ta, but you do it while you clap, so you have a sense of the physicality. And then, of course, he would do this. We'd start with like three different rhythmic figures, like two eighth notes, a quarter note, and 4/16, and we'd put the metronome on, and he at random he would point to them, and so you'd have to sing them. Sing the rhythm randomly, not knowing what was, and then he'd add, so there'd be more, that you'd have a group of, you know, eight different things, and then faster and slower and faster and slower. And then what that does is it makes you see rhythm as these units, these blocks, rather than just trying to see note at a time. So you see, you can look at and also helps you in your sight reading because you're looking ahead. You're not looking at what you're doing, you're looking forward. And you see these blocks. So now, as a player, you see, well, I see it's 4/16. I know what that is. I've internalized that. I don't have to think about it. I don't have to try and divide four in my head. I know what that is. I know what five is. I know what three is. I know what short, you know what 16th note and a dotted eighth note is, eighth note, dotted 16th, 16th, eighth, 16th. I know what all those are. And I know what they are notated differently. So like an eighth, quarter, eighth, I know what that feels like. It feels the same relatively proportionally as a 16th, eighth, 16th, or as a quarter, half, quarter, and so on. So you internalize those and then you learn them with different tempos. And then there's really nothing that, once you have those in your head, in your body, then you, and precisely in your body. So, you do that and they're correct and you have someone there saying no or yes. And, you do it more and you do it more. And it wasn't a long process. I feel like using that method, and I have, you can get someone to learn their rhythm, in a couple of months. I mean, it's really an easy thing to do because it starts so basically. And then one of my professors, my composition professor, was Robert Starrer, who wrote the rhythmic training book that a lot of universities use. And that's a great book because it's random.
Oh, really?
He use it, it's in steps. It gets more complex, but they're written randomly, so you can't predict, and you have to do this. So, that's what helped me a lot. And then after that, I was like, well, now, good. Now I really felt confident, and I still do, that I can hear, in an orchestra setting, I can hear if someone's not playing, like a quintuplet, if they're not playing the three and two kind of thing. I can hear that because I know what it feels like. So that was a great step for me.
Who are some of your other main conducting teachers throughout your life?
I mentioned the chairman and orchestra director at Brooklyn College at the conservatory there, who was very interesting. And she was a clarinet player originally and then was a conductor. She studied composition with Mio and could be terrifying. But she knew that I was interested in conducting, and she took me and her conducting assistant as private students. We had sort of ad hoc lessons every week or so. And we do, piano four hands and conduct. And, the first piece she gave me, she said, here's a score. And it was the Stravinsky Symphony of Winds. And she said, next week. I'm like, okay. Which was a great thing because, it's all that mixed meter, not as something that you have to work up to. It's like, it's a mixed meter. And, it's just like, why is four different than five than six than seven and three? I mean, it's numbers. It's just a number. And if, all you learn is four, four, sorry, things are going to be tough for you. So we got that out of the way soon. And I studied with her while I was there, and she sort of forced me to put ensembles together. And she said, I want you to do the Schubert B flat symphony. Okay. She said, go put an orchestra, go ask everyone, and we'll have it on one of our, recital concerts in whatever, 2 months or something. So I did, and that went really well. I mean, I enjoyed it. And then we put together like a chorus to do some Bach. And then after that, I was out playing. I was out of school. I had my master's there, and I taught there. And I was out playing, And I knew that I wanted to do more conducting, and I was playing freelance gigs and, not much money. And I realized that I wanted to conduct, and I actually took a job on Wall Street as an editor. And so that money sort of went to workshops, and I could, and then, putting, renting space in the beginning. And I didn't do as much playing because it was, I felt like, well, these are really crappy gigs for not a lot of money. And there's this idiot conducting it. If there's going to be an idiot conducting, it might as well be
Let it
me.
be me, yeah.
Right. Let it be me. So I really focused on conducting that way. And I started studying with a great teacher. I was with him for 4 years, Jacques-Louis Monod, who just passed away this week. There was a lovely obituary in the Times. And I learned about him through a friend of a friend who was a conductor. He knew I was looking for a teacher. He said, "Oh, you'll call Jacques and, see if he'll take you." So I called him, and Jacques Monod is a little eccentric, and he lived upper Manhattan, and this was in the mid 80s. And to get him, I had to call somebody who would give him a message. I mean, he was teaching at Columbia, but to call him at home, you had to like call this other someone who lived in the building, and they would get him. It was,
Yeah.
so he was a composition teacher mostly. He studied with Messiaen and René Leibowitz, who's not a relation to me. And but he had this little sideline in conducting teaching because he conducted the BBC orchestra in the 50s and 60s. And so I went up to his little office, his office at Columbia University, on the top, like in the attic, this tiny little office. And I met him. It was nice to meet you. And he said, "Okay, conduct something." I brought a Haydn symphony. And we sat, he sat at his desk, and I conducted in silence. And he watched me, and he watched me. And he said, "Okay." He said, "You have absolutely no technique, but we can fix that." He said, "I see there's music, so, I see inside there's music, so we'll." And I studied with him for, a bunch of years. He was never less than wonderful, and he taught me many things, and he gave me a real technique. I mean, we did stuff for both hands, independent hands, and he had a very interesting technique of conducting, in which he would place the beats. Like, imagine there's a clock in front of you, and if you're conducting in four, you actually click on six, then you click on nine, then you click on three, and then you click on one. So you're actually moving the point of the beat to those places. I did a summer workshop with Herbert Blomstedt in California. Used to do this summer long thing, and his technique was the exact opposite. His technique was the beat would always be in the same place in front of you, and it would
Oh,
be you
goodness.
would see the beat by where the rebound. So the rebound would go towards the place where you would two or three is. Okay. But I don't do either of those things. But what they do is they're both valuable to know. They're, good to have in your bag of tricks. They're valuable. I do something different, but I'm conscious of what I'm doing. And I think what Monod really taught me was a consciousness of my physicality and being aware of what I'm doing. So if I need to do something, I don't have to think about it. At this point, I mean, I'm old. When I was young, I did. But that's what studying was for. And I could, so I feel like now, because of that, I have a freedom of expression that doesn't lose clarity, which I think is very important. And people have always said they find me clear, which is great. But I think, I try and make it musical, and over the years I sort of have gotten more free, I hope. I've thought about it and worked on that. But this idea of having a solid technique so that when you get to, you know, a 7-8, an 8-8 bar that's not in 4-4, you know, that's like 3-3-2 or 3-2-3, that you have that repertoire in your physicality to do that without thinking about it. I often describe it as my work with Manoh in many ways as being, you know, he gave me this technique by giving me these like etudes, like scales, like pianists, like instrumentalists play scales. He gave me this idea of technique and how to create it for yourself and be comfortable with it, which is very important, I think. And I see, you know, when I teach young conductors in workshops or old conductors, I see them thinking and, you know, where, okay, Scheherazade, second movement, there's a fermata on the second beat. What am I going to, how's the rebound? You know, where am I going to go? How do I stop on two? And then how do I initiate three after that? You know, that type of thing. And, you know, obviously you have to look at it and plan, but you can't plan to do something that you can't do, right? So you can say, oh yeah, I'll just, you, in your study, you say, okay, this bar, I need to do this and that's fine. You know, I'll make a note of it or whatever. And so that he gave me that. I mean, he also gave me a way of looking at the music that I, that's more personal. I mean, it's harder to describe, but you know, we did a lot of different repertoire up in that attic. And, you know, he was a really wonderful guy, a wonderful teacher. At the first lesson, he said, so you'll tell me where you're conducting because I'll come see you because you're my student. I have, you know, I want to see you conduct. So you'll tell me where you're conducting because you're my student. And I was like, oh, that's, I mean, I certainly know teachers who are like, oh, you're doing a concert. Great. Have a great time. Let me know how it goes. And I did a concert that was music by this one composer, and she had written, it wasn't great, but, you know, I got hired to do it, and a lot of friends were in the orchestra, and it wasn't great. And he came, and at the intermission, he came up to me, and he said, it's okay, I know you can conduct in form going home. And I said, I agree. You should. You don't need to stay. You're not gonna. It's not gonna be. You know, it's not gonna be. You're not gonna miss anything. So you know, he was very nice to me, and it wasn't just just a anonymous student. He made me feel like I had value, which was I needed at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So. Mm-hmm. And I just saw a video of him being interviewed about 10 years ago on YouTube. It's great. It just brought back his very interesting, wry sense of humor. He said something about – he was talking about fixed zone movement. This is a guy who's edited Schoenberg and and very complex music is his thing.
Yeah.
You know, he essentially brought a lot of Schoenberg and Berg and Webern to the United States and did premieres of them. And, you know, and he was talking about when he taught somewhere about fixed dough and movable dough. And he said he suggested something that his colleagues didn't like, which was removable dough. Because he thought either of those things were ridiculous and they were absurd in many ways.
Yeah.
You know, he was very, very interesting guy. And I hear him, you know, I certainly hear his voice when I get in front of a group.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
When you're teaching at workshops, is there something that you find yourself saying very often that if everybody had already fixed that, you wouldn't have to say it and you could work on better stuff?
Workshops are interesting places. The thing about workshops that surprises me most is that students come without willingness to give up what they've learned. For me, when I've gone to workshops, I do whatever the teacher would say to me. And then when I get home, I can make a decision. It's very hard in the moment. So I always say, I would like to think that you go to a workshop, you throw everything out, and you just do what they tell you, and then you can decide. And I'm surprised most by that resistance to trying something new. I try in workshops and with all conducting students, my main concern is getting them to look comfortable, and to whether they're comfortable or not, but to look comfortable, hopefully it means that they are comfortable so that the orchestra is comfortable, because there's a tension, and it's natural when you're young, especially as a young conductor, you're constantly focused on yourself. Yeah. What am I doing? What am I doing? And you can see that in workshops. I mean, you can see it when the teacher will go up to the student and will say whatever, and you can see that their eyes will roll up in their head, and they're processing. And then when they conduct, they're sort of, the eyes roll up in their head because they're thinking about what the teacher just said, and that's fine. That's really fine. Someone I know called that the dog peeing in the ocean expression. You know, that faraway look, you're doing something and you're just sort of thinking about something else. And that's fine. But the willingness to just accept and let it flow, wash over you and do it. I would like to see more of that. But I do try mostly. I find that it's the most common thing that I need to work on is making people relax their body, get rid of the tension. Usually it's in their shoulders. They're hunched up. Their arms are up in a sort of unnatural way. You can conduct with your hands in the air, but you know, not like you're about to go 10 rounds with Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
And that happens a lot. Generally, in workshops, the thing that you need to work on is so self-evident. You know, I did a workshop with someone who hadn't done one as a teacher, great conductor, hadn't done a workshop before, and said, I'm not sure I'm going to know what to say to them. And I said, oh, you're going to know exactly. You'll see, because it'll be as though there's a spotlight shining on this one thing. It'll just be very obvious. It is, because at a young level, the things you need to work on are obvious. People are thinking, it's that thing of not being still, of thinking about what you're doing. And as soon as a conductor can get out of their own head and stop thinking about themselves, that's when, you know, music happens. You can't think about yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like what you said, that young conductors are thinking about themselves. They're very inward because they're still kind of working on that. They're really worried about that.
Of course.
And then when you see students become more mature conductors, now suddenly they're able to focus on the orchestra.
That's absolutely right.
Something has changed. Right. So yeah, you're absolutely right about that.
And physically, it's almost impossible to keep two thoughts in your head at the same time.
Yeah.
So if you're thinking about yourself, you can't hear anything.
Mm-hmm.
You can't hear what the orchestra is doing. So it's a step that everyone goes through. But the sooner you can get past that, and I think part of that is relaxing and not being so serious about yourself. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, be serious about the music, because it's only about the music. It's only about the music. It's never about you. It's never about the conductor. It's about the players and the music and doing that. And, you know, the thing that Blomstedt used to say, I'm sure he still does for conducting students, was you serve at any level, but you're serving. You serve someone. You're not being served. No one's giving you something. You're giving. Yeah. And you're giving because it's a beautiful thing to do. You're not expecting things to come back. They do. They can, and that's great. But you're there to serve. you know, serving. I always think it's a very pompous thing to say, well, we're serving the composer, but you know, you are. that is true. I mean, you know, we don't have to wear wigs and breeches when we play Mozart because we respect Mozart, but we respect the music and we want to do whatever we can to make it as good as possible.
Yeah.
And that's any level, you know, college, amateur, professional.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Perfect. Well, we're at just about time. Before we move on to some final questions, the only other two notes I had were to your radio interview. You said you had a funny story.
Oh, yeah. Well, we were talking about, you know, how interviews go and something that was sort of embarrassing. But two things. We're talking about things that you learn from. Mm-hmm. One of them is practical. When I was younger, I was doing a reading and a recording, you know, video recording for myself, but with friends of mine, and it was going really well. And I looked at the bass player and I smiled, like as if to say, "Isn't this great fun?" And he got and he immediately got lost because he thought I was looking at him like, "What did I do? What did I do?"
Yeah.
So, you know, be careful. be about the music. That's exactly why it's not about you. You know, mm-hmm. be about the music. If he did something that was great, like, yeah, that's great, but not like, "Isn't this great?" You can do that at the bar later.
Yeah.
The other thing I was mentioning, I did a radio interview that fortunately was recorded at the public radio station in Wyoming. And my host at the university was sitting there with me. And evidently he had given a press release to the interviewer, but not to me. So it's going, he's asking me questions and I'm answering them about the concert that we were doing there. Mm-hmm. Which was a really good concert. Good program, I have to say. He asked me a question and it was dead silence. I had no idea what he was, I sort of mimed to him. What? Wait, what? What do you mean? I don't know. So he stopped. And then he said, "It's all right. We'll cut that out." And I, you know, so it sort of taught me to sort of be ready for anything. But if that had been on the air, I don't know, we would have had dead air for, you know, at least what seemed like an hour, but it was a minute.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, not a failure, something that taught me things, something that taught me something important. Years ago, we did Bruckner 7, which has Wagner tubas in it. And what that taught me is that not every horn player can play the Wagner tuba. And, you know, I rented Wagner tubas for the players, and 2 weeks is not enough time. So that was a good lesson to learn. And then what we did last year, the year before, I forget, Bruckner 8. Mm-hmm. I knew much better. I went to,
That's a lesson they don't teach you in grad school.
Well, it was very, you know, what reminded me of that is thinking that dead air was felt like an hour when we did the Bruckner in the slow movement, you know, that beautiful horn, Wagner tuba chorale. And the principal was playing like a minor second away from, and it was torture. I couldn't believe it. And I was thinking, What is going on? And she was a really good player. And afterwards, she was very apologetic. And she said, you know, her armature had gotten sort of stuck on this one level where the notes that she was supposed to play weren't available. And she couldn't like break through and she didn't want to stop. And, you know, and you know, it was just a few seconds, but it felt like, you know, a week and a half in the desert. Mm-hmm. So, you know, things like that give you a practical idea, but you know, those are the embarrassing, some embarrassing things, but you know, these are instruments. They're not scalpels. No one dies.
Yeah. No.
So it's okay.
Your bass story reminded me when I was preparing my master's recital, I had developed this habit of when I was like listening, I would just kind of stare like forward. I wasn't I was still kind of working on like looking
right.
and listening at the same time.
Yeah.
And the point I had accidentally decided to stare at was right at our first bassoon. And so I kept, like, in the first couple of rehearsals, I kept, like, just zoning out, looking straight at him. And then eventually I realized that he was doing this because he just kept going, like, he kept shrugging and, like, going, like,
he was like, why are you looking
at me? What are you doing?
Me?
I'm not playing.
Oh, yeah, that's great. Yeah,
and it was always, like, times when he wasn't playing that I was trying to listen to something specific. So he was like,
and they think about, why are you looking at him? You should be looking at whoever is playing.
Yeah.
If you want to look at somebody. And I love eye contact with players. I mean, I love the idea of looking at the oboe player and going, like, okay, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
Your solo, go for it. You know, do something, make it interesting. I really love the idea that the players have good ideas.
Yeah.
Especially soloists, solo players, and that they're going to give you something maybe that you didn't think of.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of times there's more than one good idea in the room. It's not always yours.
Yeah.
So be open to it.
Awesome.
Yeah. But look at someone who's doing something. Exactly.
Well, David, we're at the hour and a half mark. This has been this has been a joy. Two last quick questions. One of our last questions is always the hidden gem. What's a piece? And you mentioned a couple, and I'll definitely encourage people. You said you had the list of everything Nairo played on the website. Is that right?
It's on my website.
I'm sure that's
my website. It's the orchestra website. Yeah. There's a little tab at the bottom of every page that says past repertoire.
Mm-hmm.
It used to say past repertoire.
Oops.
Until I noticed the typo. But now it says repertoire. Yeah.
That's a great resource. Are there any other composers' pieces you want to throw out there?
Yeah. You know, I'm very, very much a fan of Martinu.
Yeah.
I think he's a composer that is overshadowed by his contemporaries, like Shostakovich, like Bartok and Prokofiev and so on, but I think his six symphonies are as good, as great as anything written, as anything else.
Oh yeah.
Hmm. I think he's a major composer. The operas are hardly done here, are wonderful. The concertos are great. The smaller pieces are fantastic. He has this style that is Hungarian, but they sound American too. There's this openness of writing that's very reminiscent. Did I say he was Hungarian?
You said his sound is Hungarian.
No, he's Czech.
Okay. that Martinu is a name that I know, and I think most musicians know, but I can't think of any music of his that I actually would know or recognize.
Yeah, he's Czech is okay. What I doubted myself, which I shouldn't because I've done so much of his music. It must be something about the Czech language. There's this free-floating rhythm that sort of obscures strong beats.
Yeah.
And that the strong beats don't necessarily happen on downbeats. And so it's very, it can feel like you're not lost, but you're at sea, you're floating.
Okay.
And brilliant orchestration, just fantastic. And Chausson, doesn't get enough. I'm talking about dead composers right now. I think, everyone needs to look who's around now and find out and just do the work. It's work, and you got to ask people, and you got to talk to the publishers, and they'll recommend their own composers. But you have to do that. We did the Amy Beach Symphony a couple of years ago.
The Gaelic.
Terrific piece. Terrific piece. Orchestra loved it. Don't know why it's not done. It's being done more now, I think, just because. But I am a Martinu fan. And the orchestra likes it. Orchestras like his music. Also, I could go on for a long time with composers that are undervalued that should be, like Honegger and Poulenc. Oh, my God, Poulenc.
I love Poulenc.
The Sinfonietta is a major piece.
I don't know it.
It's you know, I don't know why he called it a sinfonietta. It's a 30-minute symphony.
Yeah.
And it's and it's one of the best pieces you'll hear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think conductors need to look around them more.
Yeah.
You know, not assume that what they know is all there is to know.
Yeah. Just to relate to something we talked about earlier, I worked with Larry Ratcliffe last summer to do Dvorak 7, and one of the things he was telling us was that because of the Czech language, I think Czech melodies usually will start without a pickup. I just remember that little bit of information that he shared, and I think he said Russian music was similar. Again, I may be misremembering, but just because
I'm thinking of the horn solo at the beginning of Tchaikovsky 2, and similar stuff. It starts on the beat.
Yeah.
Bum, ba ba bee, ba 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 bum.
Yeah.
One, you know, it starts on the beat.
One
yeah, I mean, you know, it's a generalization that's probably there are many exceptions to.
Yeah.
But I think there's something to it. The way French music measures are complete entities. They don't necessarily have a pickup to the next measure. They connect in a different way. You know, it's the way they connect. We'll have to do a whole score study, phrasing type of thing.
I wonder if anyone's written their dissertation on it yet.
Yeah.
Probably but somewhere.
I mean, it's not something we had a chance to talk about today, but something that I'm like, for me, score study and phrasing is just, you know, where you get to it. Anyway, another time. But
And then just our last question is what advice do you want to send everyone home with today?
It's not about you.
Yeah.
Really, I it's something I've thought about. I mean, technique is one thing, and your preparation as a musician, your solfege and your sight reading and all that is so important. You have no idea. You think those are classes that are, you know, a burden that you got to get through, but they are the most important thing. You know, doing those technical things. And then the idea that, you know, this sounds so pie in the sky and preachy, but, you know, it's a real gift to share music with other people. And as a gift, it's something you give. It's not something that you get back. You can get back huge satisfaction and the rewards. But it's not about you. And if you're conducting an orchestra that is made up of people that don't play that well, there's still something to offer them.
Yeah.
You can make them better musicians. You can make musicians at every level better.
Yeah.
And that's the job. That's the thing I like most is doing the work, is the work of working on music. You know, concerts are a bonus, but the rehearsal, you know, making something better, there's nothing more rewarding. And in order to make that happen, you really have to get out of yourself. Yeah. You have to be, again, this sounds very, very highfalutin, like a vessel. Mm-hmm. Doesn't that sound pretentious? But, you know, you have to be able to give these players the thing that they don't have, or the thing that they need and don't know that they need, or the thing that you have that you know they need, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's very ineffable and it's very vague, but, you know, you have this thing and you have to give it. And if you can do anything else, if you can possibly do anything else with your life, if you don't have to do this, don't.
Yeah.
But if you have to do it, go right ahead and give and give it. Yeah.
Well, David, thank you so much for joining. I was going to say us. Thanks so much for joining me tonight. Luke's at a rehearsal tonight.
Oh, okay. All right. So I was wondering.
That's why I'm flying solo.
Okay. It was great talking to you, Jeremy. I really enjoyed it. And, you know, I'm a fan of the podcast. So.
Awesome. Thanks so much for listening. And thanks so much for joining our guest list.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Awesome.
Talk to you soon.
Perfect. And thanks so much for scheduling. So I know it's pretty late for you over there.
Oh, it's just 10 o'clock.
Oh, that's pretty
late. It's not like I have rehearsals to go to.
Right.
Yes, music in the time of the plague.
Yeah, yeah.
It's been crazy.
Thanks so much for joining us for this episode of Podium Time. You can find everything in the show notes below, and please reach out if you have any suggestions for guests or improvements to the podcast. We're always striving to make Podium Time the best podcast that we can for you conductors and students, so send us a Facebook message or use the contact page on our website with any suggestions you may have. Thanks so much for listening to this episode, and we'll see you next time. Mendelssohn's Italian Symphony was performed by the Czech National Symphony Orchestra, and Beethoven's Egmont Overture was performed by Stefano Ligurati.